With the first pick in the 2003 NBA draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select LeBron James.
With the 13th pick in the 1996 NBA draft, the Charlotte Hornets select Kobe Bryant.
With the first pick in the 2015 NBA draft,
with the third pick in the 2018 NBA draft,
with the first pick in the 1998 NBA draft,
with the first pick in the Orlando Magic,
Michael Olcandy.
With the first pick in the 2019 NBA Draft, the New Orleans Pelicans select Zion Williamson from Duke University.
Welcome to Robin Hoop, an NBA Draft show here on Dash Radio's Nothing Net channel, where we bring rich takes to the poorly informed. This week, we are jumping into not just a player, but finding very similar to our Florida State episode, we are jumping into Arizona, another team with three NBA prospects on their roster. Now, a little bit of difference when we're looking at Arizona versus when we did Florida State. Florida State has two surefire prospects, and then they have a third that's a little more iffy just in terms of where he's going to go, if he's even going to get drafted, and that would be Trent Forrest. And I definitely... While I'm a fan of Trent Forrest, I'm just saying that when you compare that team to Arizona, Arizona's three players are all going to get drafted. That I can promise you. And so when we look at the two teams, that's just kind of where the similarities differ. So taking a look now at Arizona, the first prospect we're going to touch on this week is Josh Green. Now, Josh Green is a prospect that I have watched a lot of. I have really started to... It's interesting... My first take as I kind of dove into Josh Green film was I was a really, really big fan of his. And then in talking to some scouts and kind of going through his game a little kind of with a fine-tooth comb, if you will, especially given how much time we have now until the draft, obviously a lot more time than we would normally have, I'm still very high on Josh Green, but there are some things that I do have question marks about. Now, if you look at Josh Green, just in terms of what he is as a prospect. So when I hear the name Josh Green, the first thing that jumps out to me is defense. He is a fantastic defender. And we're talking in many different levels. He's a good team defender. He's a very good on-ball defender. Very good footwork. He's got good athleticism, so that really helps him in that area. He's able to move laterally. He has good hips on the defensive end. So those are all things that you look for when you're looking at a good defender. And to me... he really stands out in that regard. He's good enough where I think, and he's fast enough and athletic enough where I do think he's going to have no issues guarding 1 through 3, most likely. Again, it probably depends on the matchups a little bit, but he's got good size. He's 6'6", so you're not worried in terms of that. He's got a lot of things going for him on the defensive end. In terms of some of the other areas, you know, he's not known for blocks necessarily. When I project him in the NBA, I'm not thinking that he's going to be so switchable that he can play the 4 or even the 5. That's not the kind of player we're talking about here. You know, Isaac Okoro would be a player that is going to be very, very switchable, arguably 1 through 5 based on matchups. You look at a player like Paul Reed. Paul Reed will, hands of course, to me, at least, to me, I think he absolutely will be able to switch 1 through 5. I think 1 through 3 is what we're looking at for Josh Green, and probably some 4. For example, if you're playing, just as an example, the Houston Rockets, and if they were using Robert Covington at the 4, sure, I'm sure Josh Green could guard Robert Covington, right? That's a good example. So there are players that he would be... He's got to get stronger, of course. So that's more of a long-term look as opposed to right away. But right away, I do think he's going to be able to guard 1s and 2s, probably most 3s, although there's some it's going to be a little more difficult, right? If he's expected to go guard Kevin Durant, I mean, could he do it? Sure, but I think it's going to be a little difficult. There's certain players that it's going to be a little more difficult, and that's what you could say about any player. I mean, that's just the way it is. So defensively, So many things to like about him as a prospect. Not exactly a guy that's going to get you blocks. Is able to get you some steals. He really shines, though, on that defensive end when you're looking at his overall game. Now, I'm not trying to say that we should take away from offense, right? I'm not sitting here and going, all right, he's just a bad offensive player. I mean, that's not the case. But when you're looking at his strengths, it is definitely more so on the defensive end as opposed to offensively. So if we take a look at some of the more specifics and dive into the numbers, he's also a decent rebounder. He was second on his team in terms of rebounding. Now, no surprise, Zeke Nnaji was first by a lot. But 137 total rebounds, 98 defensive, and 39 offensive. And the kind of the funny thing about when you look at this team, he's one of the reasons I think that Josh Green was able to get as many defensive rebounds as he did is because Zeke Nnaji, his teammate, is actually a better offensive rebounder than he is a defensive rebounder. So that's kind of interesting there. But so good rebounder is Josh Green, 137 total rebounds. Again, we talked about how just not a guy that's going to get you a lot of blocks, only 13 on the season. I think it was like an average of like 0.9 when you're looking at the statistics. Then you dive into some other numbers, 46 steals, which is pretty good. It's over a steal a game. And steals is one thing that generally tends to translate. And I had this conversation with someone recently when I was talking about prospects, and somebody was bringing up LaMelo Ball. And what they were talking about LaMelo Ball is two things. They said LaMelo Ball is known for his defensive. They said he's a guy that you mention defense when you talk about him as a prospect. I can tell you right now that is not true. I'm not sure where this person... And to be clear, this was not just one person. This was in like a group chat, and it was pretty much a landslide. Everyone was saying, oh, come on, what are you talking about? Like, we talk about defense and we talk about LaMelo Ball in the same sentence all the time. Not true. Not at all true. And if you think that, then I'm not sure where you're getting your information from. In addition, though, one thing that people in that same group chat that I was in wanted to talk about was the defensive potential. Now, first of all, I don't think a lot of people, I have not seen a lot of people talking about the defensive potential of LaMelo Ball. I would look at it as he has potential to have defensive potential. And I say that, what I mean by that is that physically, I think he should be a decent defender, but it just has not panned out. Now, I promise there is a reason why I brought that up. It was not just to go on some crazy tangent. The reason I brought that up is because they talk about a player's defensive ability in regards to steals. And I can promise you that just because you get steals does not mean you're going to be a good defender. There are a lot of players. Here's a good example of that. I'm a Timberwolves fan, and we had a player on our team for a number of years, Kevin Martin. Everyone knows who Kevin Martin is. Kevin Martin had multiple seasons where he averaged over a steal a game. If you thought that Kevin Martin was a good defender based on that, you could not be more mistaken. Kevin Martin was a terrible defender. So I'm just telling you, do not look at steals as an indicator that a player is good at defense. You could be good at defense and be good at getting steals, but one does not equal the other. And that's just something to keep in mind when you're looking at prospects, or not everyone has the time necessarily to dive deep as I do or as other scouts do. Some people don't have that time, but when you're looking at box scores, when you're trying to analyze a player more based on the numbers than anything else, just keep in mind steals are not indicative of a player being good at defense. Could be indicative of a player just taking gambles. It's very interesting. Although I will say, we're going to talk about a player a little later on in this episode, Nico Mannion, who I think, while he's not like an absolutely amazing defender because he's got some limitations, one thing he is good at is picking those times to gamble. I do think there are players out there that are very good at that. And to me, that's a skill that absolutely can translate into being a good defender. But just gambling all the time, taking chances, look, I'm getting 1.5 steals a game, that doesn't mean a thing. It really just doesn't. Although, again, much like free throws, steals a lot of times can translate. So just keep that in mind as we kind of go through things. And even on future episodes, I think that's important when we're examining any sort of prospect. Looking at some of the other things, Josh Green, not a great passer. I saw one scout, the way he put it was, he is a good passer, but he does not have good vision, I believe is the way that they phrased it. He's not a great passer. 78 assists, 1.59 assist to turnover ratio. I mean, we're not sitting here saying that he's a terrible passer, but that's not what you're getting with Josh Green. I do think he's a fairly high IQ player. I mean, for sure on the defensive end. On the offensive end, I'm not sitting here saying, man, the guy makes a lot of mistakes. It's not like that, but I will say that he is a player that I do have a lot of concerns with on that offensive end. Now, let's go over some of the numbers here. So 36% from three. on 83 attempts. So that's 30 makes. It's not bad, right? You look at that number and you're like, oh, 36%. And then if that could translate to the pros, that'd be pretty good, right? We'd be pretty happy with that. Here's my issue when it comes to Josh Green and shooting. Before we move on to that, let's just look at one more percentage, which is free throw, 78%. He actually was one of the tops on his team as far as free throw percentage is concerned. He had 108 attempts, so he's able to get to the line. But when you watch him shoot, whether it's free throws, whether it's three-point shots, the interesting thing is that he just doesn't have consistent form. And to me, I don't care how ugly your – that's not true. I do care how ugly your form is, but you can have ugly form and you can still be a really good shooter if you're consistent. Going back to who we just – two players we just talked about, Kevin Martin and LaMelo Ball. Kevin Martin had a really, really ugly shot, but it was consistent. He always shot at the same, and that's what matters. If you're consistent – now, of course, if it's consistent and you don't make shots, yeah, change your form, right? We talked about LaMelo Ball. LaMelo Ball, actually, now I have some concerns more recently now because they just put out a video of him doing some prep in an open gym. And it's funny because Jonathan Givani of Draft Express and ESPN, he put out that how good the jump shot looked. It didn't look good. Or the shot, I guess, because it wasn't a jump shot. He wasn't leaving his feet, if I recall. It was not good, to say the least. So it was consistent. Now, the interesting thing is when I watched him play, for example, in his younger years, or if I watched him play when he was in Australia, one thing I noticed with him is that his jump shot was definitely interesting, to say the least. A very weird form. You wouldn't teach it that way, but it was fairly consistent. And when you talk about LaMelo Ball, he was not efficient, to me, not because of his shot form, it's because of his shot selection. So to me, that was different. Now, again, I have more concerns now that I've seen him in a gym than anything else. Plus, there's the report that LaMelo Ball is going to refuse to change his form. This is the form I'm using. Just accept it. Well, you know what? I have a problem with that, and I think there's some NBA teams that probably will as well. And I will say this. I've gotten to the point now where I may move LaMelo out of that top spot only because, I mean, he was tied with Denny. He's still going to be in that top tier. But I just have some concerns, and I have some things I want to kind of dive into a little more when it comes to LaMelo Ball, especially given the stuff that we're starting to hear now in between. But to translate that into Josh Green, again, is my issue there is he's not consistent. When you watch him play, his footwork isn't consistent. His release point's not consistent. He does some stuff with his hands. When he makes shots, I mean, a lot of his shots look really good. I had someone mention this comparison to me, and I think this is very apt, and I can't unsee it the second that they mention it to me, and that is Josh Green and Josh Okogie. So two players. I'm not saying they're the same players. In fact, they're not. I would say that Josh Okogie is definitely more gifted offensively, and I would say that Josh Green is probably more gifted defensively. But when you look at the two games, those are guys that are both very good defenders, and they have some question marks on offense, but I'm talking more specifically their jump shots. It's interesting because Josh Okogie at times, when he has a jump shot and it goes in, and I'll say, that looks pretty good. I like some of the things that he's got going there, and the jump shot isn't this big issue I have. And then he shoots another shot, and you're like, what was that? Like, where did that come from? And so consistency is key. Now, in the case of Josh Okogie, we've seen some videos of him this summer. The jump shot's starting to look a little better, which is good to see. When we talk about Josh Green, I do think he's going to have to put in the work to be more consistent. One thing someone mentioned recently was how people love to talk about the idea of 3-and-D players. And a lot of guys get kind of put into that label coming into the draft. But when you really dive into it, there's not a lot of guys that actually are 3-and-D. It's one thing to just say it. You know, you say, okay, this guy's a decent shooter. He's a really good defender. Boom, 3-and-D. Oh, this guy's a great three-point shooter. He's a pretty good defender. Boom, 3-and-D. And we're putting that label on so many different players, and I don't think we should be doing that. I wish I could give credit to the person that brought that point up, but it escapes me at the moment. So you know who you are. And all I want to say about that is when you look at Josh Green, is there potential for him to be a 3-and-D guy? Of course there is. But he's going to need to put in a lot of work to be consistent there. That 36%, to me, is a little misleading. Not because it wasn't a big sample size or a big enough sample size, because you know we're talking about a decent amount of makes. You know, when you look at him on the season, he had, 53 makes, 30 makes out of, let's see, 30 makes out of 83. So not a gigantic sample size by any means. In fact, think about this. His teammate, Nico Mannion, had almost just about double the amount of three-point attempts. So you're not drafting Josh Green for his shooting. You are drafting him for his defense. And I will say this. His defense is going to translate day one. But the question that you have to ask yourself is Josh Green going to be so good on defense that you can play him immediately and it'll outweigh the question marks that we have on the offensive end? That's the question you have to ask yourselves if you're drafting him. If you're a team out there that's saying, all right, what are we going to do with this pick? Now, in terms of where he's going to go, I would guess he probably goes somewhere in that like 15 to 20 range. That's my guess as of right now. That obviously could change. And I don't know where I'm going to have him on my personal big board when it's all said and done. But that's where I look to see him probably get drafted, is somewhere in that 15 to 20 range. And that's where the teams have to ask, how good is his defense? Me personally, I think it's maybe elite. Maybe elite's the right word. I just think he's such a good defender. Now, diving into his offensive statistics and looking at the numbers on Synergy, the one thing that's interesting to me is when we go through these stats player by player, he's one of the first players that has literally nothing in the excellent category. He's got a few things that are in the very good, but he has nothing even in the 80th percentile, which is crazy to me. I mean, absolutely nothing there. Now, when you talk about areas that he is listed in that very good rating, it's things like transition. He's got a good transition rank. He's in just about the 80th percentile, but 79. And just when we're talking about the specifics of the fact that he's not listed in excellent in any of the generalized categories, that's a question. Now, an interesting thing here, in transition, when you get rid of the general numbers, dive into more of the specifics and what gets you to that point, when you look at his transition numbers, one thing that's interesting is when he's a ball handler, his rank is in the 97th percentile. That's, to me, a huge indicator. And we're not talking about a tiny sample size, 27 possessions. So, you know, that's, I guess I don't know how many games Arizona played last year, but you're looking at a minimum of, you know, one a game on average, let's say. And then almost 1.4 points per possession out of that, 37 points. So that's a sample size that's, it's a decent-sized sample in terms of, because he's not a point guard. And so for him to be an off-ball player, a wing specifically, and he has that many parts of his game where they've shown him as a transition ball handler, in the modern NBA, that cannot be understated, the importance of that, because you're talking about a guy that can get that ball. He's a decent rebounder, so he can grab that rebound and push the basketball. And he can get you in transition. And when he is that ball handler, clearly he makes good decisions because the team scores. So that's one of the areas when you dive into more of the specific numbers where, yeah, he does have that excellent rating. 97 percentile is nothing to scoff at. That's very, very solid. But then you look at some of the other numbers, and it's a lot of low numbers. I mean, in some of the other areas, I should say. And so that's where you really have the concerns as far as what I'm looking at. Now, when you're looking at some of the other specifics, other areas, when he spot up and has a no-dribble jumper, 57 possessions. He is actually in the excellent when you go over that number as well. Almost 1.3 points per possession, 88th percentile. So he's been very solid with the no-dribble jumper. Crazy thing, though, that number is cut more than in half when you do add in a dribble jumper. So that's one thing that's a little interesting. Now, one thing when you talk about his game is he does have the ability to – he has a pretty good floater, right? That's something that you want to watch about his game. But he's just not a good finisher. And the crazy thing is, and this is a statistic that someone pointed out to me, and I can't unsee it, is that he just refuses to finish with his left hand. So when you watch him play, you start to notice that he can dribble with both hands, and it doesn't seem to be an issue. But when you ask him to finish with his left hand, non-existent. It does not happen, which is crazy to me. And in fact, I was watching, I believe it was the game where it was Oregon at Arizona. And in watching that game, all of a sudden, he makes this really cool move, makes a spin move, finishes with the left hand, and I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, he finished with his left hand. Given that my understanding of the stat is that in AAU and his 1 year at Arizona, he finished with the left hand twice, two times, and that was one of them. And it was super impressive, and it was one of those things where it was almost instinctual. So if he got out of his own head and just played the game, I do think he would have that ability to finish with his left hand. But not only does he not finish with his left hand, he goes out of his way not to finish with his left hand. And in some cases, I've watched, he does this weird thing where he'll be in position where a left-hand shot would make the most sense. And instead, he does this weird, like, two-handed push or like two-handed throw at the basket. And let me tell you, it's not effective. It is not effective. So, again, looking at his overall offensive game, there's a lot of concerns. I do have question marks when it comes to his game on that offensive end. And I think that's fair to say. You look at him, and he has a lot of areas to improve. So, again, what we're looking at when you're talking with Josh Green is he going to be so good defensively that it outweighs the liability he has the potential of being on offense? Or, if you're a scout, you say to yourself, can we fix his jump shot? Can we get it to a point where it's consistent enough where that 36% from three translates into the NBA? And now we're talking he's, what, league average or right around there. And if you can be that, as long as you can have the gravity to pull defenders towards you, you do enough that teams have to pay attention to you on the offensive end. Now you add in that really high-level defense, and there's a lot to like about Josh Green as a prospect. But it's not a certainty. It's not a certainty that those things are going to happen. And so that's what you want to watch for when it comes to Josh Green. A team that takes him is going to have to be smart about how they use him. Now, a couple of things I want to kind of look at a little bit. When you look at in the half court, catch-and-shoot possession. So when he's in the catch-and-shoot and he's unguarded, he is 94th percentile. 94th percentile, 41 possessions, 62 points, over 1.5 points per possession, which is huge. When you look at jump shot range, and you look at the in the half court, of course, long, so three-point jump shots, he is in the 84th percentile as far as three-point jump shots long, and that is 67 possessions, 78 points, almost 1.2 points per possession. So these are just kind of interesting things to look at as far as the good aspects of his game. Now, again, there's some things. We talked about how he's not great at the finishing, right? How about this? So in the half court, shot attempts around the basket, and this is not post-ups, so this, but finishing at the hoop, 8%. 8%. 56 possessions. That is awful. That is awful. 8 percentile, 0.786 points per possession. So these are real things that you want to look at, and these are things that teams, so NBA teams are sitting here going, all right, these are things I want to look at. But when you look at Josh Green again, the big things you're looking at is the things he can do in transition, which I do think are going to translate. I do think that's going to be something, a part of his game, and given his athleticism, I look for a team to use him in transition if you can get him to be a really consistent spot-up shooter, because in general, 77th percentile there, over a point per possession, and it's not a small sample size, 133 possessions. So these are the areas that you want him to focus on. And this goes back to the conversation of what makes a player a 3-and-D player, and are they actually a 3-and-D player in practice, or is it more in theory? And to me, when I look at Josh Green, I think the potential's there for him to solidly be good enough defensively that he's going to be, and he's going to be decent enough offensively where it makes some sense. So I personally am a Josh Green fan. I'm not sure you'd know that from this conversation just because I did want to dive deep into the issues that are apparent. There are problems with his game. And so that's something to watch for going forward. You've been listening to Dash Radio's Nothing Minute Channel. This is Robin Hoop, NBA draft coverage. And now we are going to jump in with a great guest to talk Josh Green. Welcome back to the Robin Hoop Draft Show on Dash Radio's Nothing But Net channel. This week, our focus is on Arizona prospects, and we are going to dive in now to the prospect, Josh Green. And for that, we are joined by Ben Pfeiffer. Ben, looking at your vast resume, the Maneater, which is the voice of the students at the University of Missouri, Prep Sports for the Columbia Tribune and Mexico Ledger, and of course, covering the NBA draft for one of my favorite shows, Prep to Pro Podcast. And then Rookie Wire with USA Today. And all while you're also at the School of Journalism for Missouri, I can only assume what's next, curing the common cold?
I think we have to deal with COVID first, but that'll come next, sure.
I like it. I like it. So as we jump in here, let me start with just your personal draft board. When we talk about Josh Green, I know one of the most recent ones I saw from you, he was around 16th, I believe. Where do you have him currently in this draft class?
Yeah, I've lowered him a little bit since then. It's been a while since I've like formally updated or like worked with my rankings, but he's in like the 20, early 20-ish range for me at the moment. That's kind of where he settled, and I think that's kind of where I'm going to end up end up with him eventually.
When you look at Josh as a prospect, what is it that really stands out about his game to you?
I think like it's just the combination of, you know, intelligence and feel for the game and athleticism really stands out. He's a defense first prospect to me. Really just like preternaturally elite feet and hips, his hip mobility and ability to change directions while sliding on the ball is truly elite. It's probably the best in this class. He's like an unbelievable closeout defender, you know, just flipping his hips and, you know, changing directions to stick with an attacker. You know, he's elite mirroring guys on the ball. I mean, his only real weakness on ball is that he's like not super big or strong. Only 6'5", not the strongest guy in the world, but he can pretty much hang with anyone in terms of lateral burst and agility. And then he's super smart defending off the ball, you know, has to take some risks and has some lapses, but he's, you know, very young and that happens with the young guys, but he's super smart making rotations. So just an awesome defensive prospect. Offensively, you really like some of the passing flashes that he shows, you know, on and off the ball. And you love, you know, the open floor athleticism, but the offense is where a lot of the issues really lie with him.
The interesting thing about him as a prospect, when you look offensively, is so as a ball handler, he can use both hands, but he flat out basically refuses to ever finish with his left hand. Mm-hmm. So the stat I saw recently is that if you count AAU and then his first year with Arizona, he finished with his left hand twice.
Yeah,
which is crazy to me. And what's interesting is in many instances where like a left hand would make some sense, a lot of times he'll throw up this weird like two-handed shot, like almost like he's just like, there's no way I'm using my left hand. Does that concern you? Because to me it's weird.
Yeah, it's absolutely concerning. You know, it's really, really stark inability to use like that stat you cited. Like that's probably true. I haven't tracked it myself, but like I certainly believe that he just does not like he will go to like you said, extreme lengths to avoid finishing with that left hand. And it's not like he's a good righty finisher either. I believe he's in like the 8th percentile or something at the rim. I don't have the stats in front of me, but like it's not good. Like and you know that's a huge issue for him, because you know role players, which you know he projects as, need to contribute in multiple ways and need to find some way to score. And I don't really know how Josh Green scores, because he despite being like a solid athlete, he can't really finish. Like he goes to those floaters a lot, which he's pretty good at those floaters. He has a nice touch, but I'm not sure how consistent of a weapon that will be at the next level, you know, if he just cannot finish at all. And then, you know, if he's, you know, the shot is the big question, where, you know, though the percentage was solid this year and he's a solid free throw shooter, I have a hard time buying the shot because of a couple reasons. One, I've done research and written about, you know, this, that shot three-point volume and versatility in terms of types of shots like off movement, off screens, pull-up jumpers, spot-up jumpers are two of the probably the most important indicators to projecting jumpers, and Josh Green ranks very low in both of those. So I mean, and he's always been, you know, kind of gun shy and not trigger happy going back to like his high school days. So because you know, if he can't finish and he can't shoot, then he has to be really, really good on defense to get on the floor at the NBA level. So yeah, that finishing is hugely important. And he really, that's one thing that, you know, maybe he could improve because he is such a good open floor athlete, but you know, if he doesn't improve, that might not be able to stay on an NBA floor, like at least not in high leverage moments.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that your athleticism can make up for, especially on the defensive end. But on the offensive end, it's so much more difficult to cover up obvious flaws. And like you said, finishing, he's not consistent as a shooter. It's weird. You'll watch him shot to shot, and it looks sort of similar, but sometimes like his finish is a little different, and his follow-through is a little different. His footwork is a little weird sometimes. And so a lot of it's going to be consistency. The good thing, and I think the good news for a team that drafts Josh Green, is when I look at prospects, to me, it's much easier to get a guy to fix a jump shot than it is to get them to be a high-level defender. And so to me, if you're an NBA team, you say to yourself, right, he's so good defensively, I have to look at my coaching staff and say, guys, can we make him into a shooter? Because to me, the finishing, he's a good athlete, but some guys just aren't good finishers. I mean, that's just the way it is. To me, I've seen enough as a shooter where I do think that he could get better in that role, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think Josh Green is like a lost cause as a shooter at all. I mean, there's some guys who I think that of. Green is certainly not one of them. Like, I mean, he shows good touch on his floaters and on his free throws. He's shown an ability to hit spot ups. Like, I mean, there is some inconsistency with the mechanics. Like, he has like quite a bit of valgus compression with his knees bending inward, which is probably my biggest concern with his general mechanical issues. But like, that's, you know, that, you know, is more like a core strength lower body issue. But that's all like somewhat fixable. But yeah, I mean, I think just the offensive self-creation is the really big issue, because like, he has like the impressive passing for a guy of his role. Where he can like kind of run a secondary pick and roll or like lead a break, which is something he didn't do often at Arizona just because that wasn't his role, but he really can do pretty effectively. And if, you know, if you can unlock the shot to, you know, the shot doesn't have to be elite or anything. It just has to get to a point where defenses really respect him and are willing and like have to close out, because then, you know, you can attack closeouts and, you know, pass the ball, and, you know, he'll be a passer, probably not a finisher, but even then, that's some added value. I like, again, like, not a lost cause shooter, but like, I don't have tons of confidence in the shot being, you know, super good. If I had like more confidence in the shot, he'd be much higher on the board for me because of how much I like him as a defender. He's really, really incredible defensively. Yeah, I mean, I don't think him improving as a shooter is totally out of the blue or a crazy thing to assume, which is why I can definitely understand someone having him even higher than I do.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you could see it happening, but it's not a guarantee, because like you said, if he could shoot, we're talking about him at a much higher rate. It's funny that he's not the only guy in this draft class where you say if he could just do this one thing, we'd be talking about him in the top 10. There's a lot of guys, I think, in this draft class that are really good at a few things, but they're just lacking in one area that would really set them apart from other players. Someone gave me this comparison, and I can't unsee it now every time I watch Josh Green play. And it's funny because they have the same name. But what are your thoughts on the comparison that he's a very similar prospect to Josh Okogie?
I think they're a little different. I wasn't like super in tune with the draft when Okogie was coming out. But sure, from what I know about them, I think Green's probably like a little more advanced in terms of like feel and intelligence. And I think Okogie is probably a better athlete, even if marginally, but like, I mean, I get the general idea of it. I think Green's like raw skill wise in other ways than Okogie. But again, like I'm not like super in touch with Okogie. I think Green's probably a worse shooting prospect too, but I mean, I get the comparison. I haven't exactly heard that. Okogie has the advantage as like a self creator, I think, as well. But like, I mean, I get the comparison in terms of like a defense oriented prospect. But again, like, I don't know enough about prospect Okogie to like confidently say I agree or disagree with it.
The biggest thing for me, so I'm based out of Minnesota, so I've watched quite a bit of Josh Okogie, and I hadn't watched him as much, you know, in his time at Georgia Tech when he was in college, but when I look at Josh Okogie, it's kind of a similar thing where you see a team that's trying to, he's obviously a very good defender, but they're trying to get him to be a good shooter, and it just hasn't panned out yet. And they've put in the work, and that's my concern with Josh Green, is you can put in the work, but it's not just going to happen overnight. And so that's why where you kind of have him in terms of your big board, I think that makes a lot of sense. That's one of those things where you look at him as a prospect, and you want to make sure that you find a way to you know, cover up those flaws. That's going to be, you know, a big part of that. We talked a little bit about him being a solid passer. I thought it was interesting. I listened to a scout recently that said he's a solid passer, but he has poor accuracy. But then they added in he's a quick decision maker. And so when I look at that aspect of his offensive game, I kind of think it's a little bit underrated. And if you could really tap into that ability more, he'd be that much more versatile and that much more valuable on the offensive end.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty dang good passer. I like his passing a lot. I think that assessment is fair. You know, like I said, not like the most technically advanced passer. You know, has some legible stuff with either hand. Yeah, I mean, I agree that. I mean, I don't know if I really agree with him being a good decision maker, because decision making is more than passing. He makes good passing decisions, but he's like so gun shy as a shooter sometimes that I think that that is certainly an issue when it comes to his overall decision making. But he's certainly, like, you know, quick ball mover, you know, has moments where he can really, you know, like I said, run a pick and roll, attack a closeout, and make some fairly advanced reads. Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I think the passing and his shooting blend a lot in terms of value there. Because, you know, if he can't, like, if he can't, you know, have any gravity of his own, players won't close out to him. You know, they won't respect his shot or his finish. You know, there's just not going to be, you know, any real passing windows to exploit. But, you know, like he has burst off of the catch, and, you know, even some attacking off the dribble, his handle isn't that great, but, like, when he can use it, his burst allows him to get downhill. And I think if he can open those windows, I think there's definitely an impressive pass there. Because, I mean, like he's great moving the ball, making quick decisions in the zone, like, you know, against teams' defenses. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some more passing to unlock there if a team is going to be willing to use him that way.
One thing I think would be really – there's two things, I guess, that I look at his game, and I say I think he's going to be a really nice fit, especially in the modern NBA. One is his ability to push, not necessarily – as the ball handler, but he looks to run up the court out of defensive possessions, which I think is really valuable in today's NBA. But also, he's going to have the potential, especially if he gets a little more size, to be a switchable player on defense. So guarding multiple positions, I think both of those skills are very, very important in today's NBA.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure how much I agree with the switching. I mean, I mean, 6 foot five or 6 foot six with like a okay wingspan, I think like adding strength is going to be the thing to guard off there, because he certainly has like the quickness and the hip mobility, like I said, to hang with more than I mean certainly I think he's going to be able to guard ones, twos, some threes. I think he's gonna have trouble with some of the bigger threes and definitely the fours, but I mean, yeah, you know, he could add strength. You know, hopefully adding strength wouldn't mess too much with his ability to, you know, quickly move his hips around and burst off laterally. But, you know, I mean, yeah, that's just another avenue for potential improvement with Green. Yeah,
but I think that's a good give and take. Yeah, you're right. If you get too much strength, you can lose some of that flexibility just in terms of speed, quickness. And with a prospect like Green, you want to make sure that you don't lose any of that, because that's really where you get his value at. Would you say, if you're a team drafting, let's say, in the 20s, which a lot of the teams obviously drafting in the 20s are generally going to be some of those better teams, unless you've made some sort of a trade. Is he a guy that could help out day one because he's good enough defensively? Or are there enough concerns offensively where you think he'd be a guy that's going to be a little bit more of a wait and see?
I don't think I would say he's a right away contributor, at least not like – maybe like as like an eighth or ninth man off the bench, but I just don't think he's good enough offensively at this point to contribute. I mean, he could play in like a bench rotation and be fine, I think. I just worry too much about the offense for him to be really effective. I mean, he's going to be a good defender from day one. I'm pretty confident in that. And I think he'll be able to contribute on that end from day one. But the question is he going to be good enough on defense from day one to make up for his offensive deficiencies? And I mean, he certainly could be in time, you know, as the shot, the finishing, some of the more decision-making stuff marginally improves, you know, the level to which he has to be, the level to which Green has to be good offensively is lower than a lot of other guys just because of how much he adds on defense. I would be wary of a day one contribution. I mean, you look at a guy like a prospect like Jarrett Culver last year, who, you know, is not really that similar to Green, but someone who, you know, was just atrocious on offense in his rookie season, and then, you know, was pretty solid defensively, but was just not able to really contribute super, like he played a lot, but he just wasn't very good because of that the massive offensive deficiency. He could get on the floor, but I'm not sure he'd be very good that way.
Yeah, the Culver thing's so funny because, you know, as a Wolves fan, a lot of people, when we drafted him, Wolves fans are going, well, he was one of the most NBA-ready prospects, and you watch him in the NBA, and you're like, no, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, he's just like a, you know, like I had Culver like as my second-ranked prospect last year. I love Jarrett Culver. I still have faith in him being better than he was last year offensively. But, you know, it just shows like how valuable shot, like the ability to get your own shot really is. Do I think his 40% free throw drop off is real? Like, I think there's got to be some fluke there. I mean, you don't go from a 70-75% free throw shooter to a 40% one in one season. So I think there's probably something there that's going to be – I think he's due for some positive regression, but it's clear that, you know, myself and many others underestimated the level of shot creator and finisher and handler and decision maker he needed to be to thrive at the NBA level. And I mean, just to put that into perspective, he's a better dribbler, probably a better passer, a better finisher, a better overall offensive self-creator than Josh Green is right now. So, and I would say Green is probably the better defensive prospect, but Culver was definitely better offensively coming out. And still, like, we saw how poor Culver was offensively. So, you know, that's part of the reason why I'm just so worried about Green's offense early in his career.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. And in the comparisons, when you look at it, I would agree. Those, when you look at the offensive, obviously, for me, Culver's a much better offensive prospect. And I'm with you. I think he tends to have the ability. I've watched and seen his improvements that I do think that he becomes a better player. And he probably
Culver did get better, I think, as the season went on.
He did. Although, to be fair, it probably would have been tough to not get better because watching him at the beginning of the season, it was tough. And you mentioned the free throws. Free throws generally are something that definitely translate. And to me, it looks like it's 100% mental with Culver. He looks, when he's up there, like he's like afraid, like, oh, this better go in. Like, I really need this to go in, because I think that's something he's definitely going to get back to more his college levels. And then when you jump into Josh Green, it's like you said, he's a better defensive player, but is he going to be good enough to overcome the offensive concerns? And he has more concerns than Culver. And so that's where you run into the question, is he going to be able to contribute right away? Most teams, probably not. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, that's kind of where
So let me end it with this. Looking ahead to the draft, we don't know what the pre-draft process is going to be. We really don't know what's going to happen there. But if you had to guess, where do you think Josh Green likely goes in the draft? Where should he go? And is there a team or teams that you think would be good fits?
I guess he probably goes in like that late teens-ish range. That seems to be kind of where he's like been projected for a long time. And I would kind of guess that's where he stays. And I also think that's generally the right range for him. Like ESPN, like Draft Express has him as like 22 on their best available, which, you know, I believe them as reputable in terms of like Intel rankings over other outlets. I mean, 22-ish, that seems like a good range for, and I think that's a good range for Josh Green. Like, I mean, like you said, there's a lot of really good teams. I mean, you look at that 18, 19, 20, like you have Dallas, Brooklyn, Miami, Philly, Denver, Milwaukee. Like, those are teams that wouldn't really need him to contribute right away. And, you know, especially teams like Milwaukee and, you know, Miami have really strong developmental infrastructures to, you know, hopefully get him to shoot, get him to play to his full potential. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's like really like a specific context fit he needs at this point, just because I don't think he's ready to contribute anywhere. I don't think he's good enough offensively, you know, unless there's a team really committed to just letting him run and, you know, like putting that closeout attacking passing to use. And, you know, if they can improve the shot, just, you know, a team like teams, you know, I think any of those good teams, cause you know, teams can never have enough wings. I think Dallas would be a really cool fit. I mean, they're not super, I mean, they could use more wing defenders though. I mean, Josh Green isn't exactly a wing defender. He's kind of like a 2.5 to me. But I mean, he'd fit really well there with Luka creating shots for him. I mean, I think he works in Miami. I think Philly is an interesting one that I've seen, though he doesn't really fit the shooting/shot creation they need. I mean, more athletic wings is always good. So I think like a lot of those good teams in that like early 20s, late teens range is kind of where I'd tab as the best spots for Green.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's kind of the area, like you said, Draft Express, when it comes to intel and mock drafts, they tend to be the one that is the most accurate. So before I let you go, where can people remind our listeners where people can find you on social media, and then what stuff you have coming out, whether it be Prep to Pro or anywhere else?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Ben_Pfeiffer_. Like you said, most of my work at the moment in terms of the draft is my podcast, Prep to Pro, with Max Carlin. We're doing, you know, as we've been doing since March, weekly, biweekly episodes. And now that we finally have a date for the drafts and that college basketball season is nearing and the NBA is coming to a close and the combine is now, we're going to have more and more relevant content than ever. So, you know, that's basically the main place I'm doing my draft stuff at the moment, because, you know, life is busy with school and other work. You know, I might have, you know, I'll probably post like a formal board update at some point. I'm not sure what else I'm going to be doing for draft content in the future, but yeah, just go listen to my podcast, Prep to Pro. You can find us on Apple and Spotify, all of the places where you find your podcasts.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk again down the line.
All right. Thank you very much.
Now we jump into our next prospect for this week, and it is another Arizona prospect, of course. And what we're doing is we're kind of going in the order of how they're most likely going to go in the draft. And the next guy, in my estimation, that goes is probably going to be Zeke Nagy. Zeke Nagy, of course, is the big man, if you want to call him that, from Arizona. He is a center or power forward, just kind of depending on how you want to label him. Now, when I look at Zeke Nagy's game, he is a very intriguing prospect. I would argue that he's a little bit of a project, depending on how the team that drafts him wants to use him. Now, I think he's one of those guys that's going to go probably late first, early second. Very similar, actually, probably to Nico Mannion, which is why it's tough to say which one's going to go first. But Zeke Nagy is a very good player, a very good athlete. So there's lots to like about his game in that aspect. When you look at both offensive and defensive parts of his game, I would say that he's a good player. But both offense and defense, I do think there are some areas that he really needs to improve if he's going to be a good player at the next level. So let's focus a little bit. Let's start with the defensive end. One thing I watched, for example, in I believe it was a game against, I think it was Oregon, the game where they went into overtime. There were a number of possessions where they would pull Zeke Nagy out of the game for his taller teammate, whose name escapes me at the moment, but they would pull him on the defensive end. And I think part of that is he doesn't have a ton of length. He's not sitting there with a huge wingspan. I believe his wingspan is around 7'1". I'm not saying that's bad necessarily, but he's not known for blocks. That's one thing that you want to kind of get ahead of right away when you're talking about Zeke as a prospect. And again, I like Zeke as a prospect. I just don't love him. He's good. He's not great. And that's why I talk about him as being sort of a little bit of a project, because there's a lot of aspects of his game that are going to take some time to really and truly develop into the player that you want him to be. When I project out his career in the NBA, he's a good enough athlete and he moves well enough on the perimeter. And now I will say this, that's not something when I watched that I really necessarily noticed was that, but enough other scouts I've seen talk about this that I do think that he moves well enough on the perimeter. And if he can continue to work on that aspect of his game, I think there's some switchability for him in the NBA. The biggest thing for me is going to be shooting and the offensive side of things. So defensively, we talk about how he's able to move pretty well. He's a good rebounder. We talked about this actually in the Josh Green segment, but interestingly enough, when you talk about rebounding, he's a better offensive rebounder than he is a defensive rebounder, which is crazy. And I wonder how that aspect translates to the NBA, but he gets after it. When you watch him go for rebounds, I mean, rebounds, he gets after it. He does. He goes for the rebounds. There's a reason why he led the team in boards. Now, again, as far as minutes and as far as position, it makes sense that he's the guy that leads the team in rebounding. But he was very, very talented in his first season. So let's not take away from that. He was voted Pac-12 player of the or rookie of the year, or freshman of the year, I guess, is what it would be in college. So it's one of those things where I do think there's a lot of things to like about his aspects of his game. It's just going to take some time to get the player that I think most teams would want. When you watch him as a shooter, let's start with that. I think he has a very good-looking jump shot. Now, he's no Patrick Williams, right? I couldn't rave more about Patrick Williams and his jump shot, but he does have a good jump shot. The concern I have is that it's a very small sample size when you look at specifically his ability to stretch the floor. His overall offensive numbers, so let's look at the synergy a little bit here. So 93 percentile overall for him on the offensive end, very excellent, of course, over a point per possession. You're looking at him in transition, also very good. He's actually, I shouldn't say very good because that's an actual rating. These are all excellent. So whether it's transition, whether it's the overall half court, he shines. I mean, he really, really does. And when it comes to versus man versus zone, he was actually very, very effective. 91st percentile against man and 71st percentile, which isn't bad necessarily against the zone. So those are things to kind of keep in mind as we're jumping in here. Now, we talked about how important transition was to, I think, Josh Green and what he's going to be able to do at the next level. And a lot of that is because of his speed, his athleticism. And one thing I noticed when you watch Zeke Najee is he's very smooth. He's a very smooth athlete. He runs well. And when you compare him to, let's go, if we're going to say that Zeke Najee is a big man, which I do have question marks about him playing the center position, for example. But if you're going to classify him as a big man, and if you're going to look at a player, some of the other big men that we've talked about, and here's a good example. So there's two big men that come to mind at the opposite ends of the spectrum. So first we look at Paul Reed. And the reason I bring up Paul Reed is because he's very switchable, maybe the most switchable player in the class. What you want from Zeke Najee, if he's going to really reach that potential and that maximum, you're going to need him to be able to guard multiple positions. And he's a good enough athlete where, like I said earlier, I do think he's going to eventually be able to do that. When you watch him move, I almost get the sense of calling him a forward when I watch Zeke Najee play as opposed to a big man. Now, that's where I bring up Jalen Smith as the other guy. So Paul Reed, very switchable. Jalen Smith, not switchable at all. And the reason I say that is he is a center. When he moves, you say to yourself, that is a center. He doesn't glide. He's not real free-flowing, if that makes sense. And he's a very good center as far as defensively is concerned. Jalen Smith has a lot of teams that really like him. My understanding is that he is I think most people probably view him higher than I do. I don't love Jalen Smith. I like him. And so when I look at Zeke Najee's game, we need Zeke to be more of a Paul Reed than we need him to be a Jalen Smith. And at least when you watch him play physically, athletically, he definitely is more in that Paul Reed camp. Not the same player by any means, not a comparable player to Jalen Smith, but those are the two types of prospects that you're looking at and you're saying, all right, he needs to be more towards the Paul Reed end of the spectrum when you're talking about his ability to guard multiple positions. And again, like I said, I view him as more of a forward. And so if you can get him to be able to guard threes and fours, threes is going to be tough. I think, to me, he's going to come in and four is going to be his wheelhouse. For me personally, I think four is going to be his wheelhouse. Some fives, again, like we always talk about, it's going to depend on matchups. The other thing that I think about when I talk about Zeke Najee is if, you know, when you look at positions of a player, right, it's all based on what you can guard or who you can guard, right? That's the biggest thing that you kind of look at when it comes to that. And so if he's able to be switchable, he's going to be able to play multiple positions. But then when you jump over to the offensive end, that's where I start to have some question marks a little bit. So we talked about how he's in that excellent rating stance in offense in general, right? But if he's going to be really successful at the next level, we need him to be able to hit three-pointers. And I don't know that that's a sure thing. It's definitely not assured when you look at the specifics of his shooting numbers. First of all, does not take a lot of three-point shots. That is not a big part of his game. In fact, if you look at the overall numbers, he only attempted 17 three-pointers, made five of them, 29%, and which actually, you know, when you look at 29% just on the surface, you say to yourself, you know, 29% for like a big guy is not bad, but it's just not something that I trust. You get nothing out of 17 attempts, right? Another guy in this class that people like to tout as a three-point shooter is James Wiseman, but we haven't seen him do that, just like we really haven't seen a large sample size of Zeke Najee being able to do that. But I like his jump shot enough where if he can find a way to be consistent, and I'm not talking about a guy that's going to be hitting three-pointers all over the gym. I'm not talking about a Karl Anthony Towns type player. What I'm talking about is a guy that's going to be able to, at a minimum, much like we talk about Josh Green, at a minimum be a threat from outside. I do like his potential as a mid-range shooter, although in the modern NBA, the mid-range is not a shot most teams are really focusing on because it's not valuable. It's not a valuable shot. If you're in the NBA today, what they want you doing is scoring inside, and they want you scoring three-point shots. And that makes the most sense because if you're scoring inside, you're more likely to get foul calls. It's an easier shot. Your percentages jump. You're going to be a more efficient team if you focus on those aspects of the offensive end. When I watch him play, I look at a player that I wouldn't call him a modern big man. I would look at him as someone that strives to be a modern big man. He has the capability and the tools to do it. He just isn't there yet. And so that's going to be the biggest thing. You know, when we talk about kind of your stereotypical or your normal big man, a guy that works in the post, he does have that ability. 88th percentile, 1.1 points per possession, 94 possessions, 104 points. He is in the excellent category when you're looking at the post-up positions. Let's be honest, it's not all rainbows here when we're looking at the post-up situation with Zeke Nagy. When it comes to defense committing on him and him passing out, average or below average, it's a that's an area where he needs to get better. And then you add in when he is set up with a hard double team, so that when we're looking at those hard doubles, that's another area where it's just not, it's not great, to say the least. Now, he wasn't a player that was necessarily doubled a lot, but he does have improvements there. I just think in general, when you look at the statistics, when you watch him, he does need to get better as far as passing out of those double teams, being able to pass out of the post. You know, an interesting dynamic, there's players in the NBA, for example, again, I hate to always go to my Timberwolves, but a player that at times struggled with this was Al Jefferson. Al Jefferson, when he was with the Timberwolves, at times, just didn't. It was one of those things where it's a little bit of a skill to know when the proper time is to pass out. Not necessarily just making a good pass, but knowing when to make the pass is something that I don't think everyone possesses. So these are just areas of I'm not going to necessarily say they're areas of concern. I do think he's going to improve in that aspect of his game. So it's something to watch for. Some other things as a cutter, and this goes back to how I do think that he's going to be able to play multiple positions, but Zeke as a cutter, that's an aspect of his game that I think is a little bit underrated, I guess. So when you talk about basket cuts, he is in the 80th percentile, 80th rank, and 1.46, almost 1.5 points per possession, and it's not a small sample size. We're talking about 52 possessions. As far as basket cuts are concerned, and that's in the very good percentile. So it's good to see there's things to like about his game on the offensive end, but there are concerns. And so that's the kind of thing you have to watch for. We talked earlier about how he's a better offensive rebounder than he is a defensive rebounder, and that's actually shown when you talk about putbacks. Offensive rebounding, so his overall offensive rebounding when you account for putbacks, so 79 possessions in the 82nd percentile, almost 1.3 points per possession. No shock, he's very good in that aspect. And it's interesting, they have it listed as short rebound and long rebound. You're not getting a lot of possessions where you grab a long rebound and you get putbacks for obvious reasons. So I really like that portion of his game, and there's a lot to like about Zeke Nagy, but to me, the thing that's going to tip the scales is he has to be able to have a reliable three-point shot. That's going to be crucial. And in addition, if he can continue to get stronger, because I do think he needs to get a little stronger, he's going to be able to defend multiple positions if he can get stronger without losing that flexibility or that mobility. So those are the things that I look at when I think of Zeke Nagy. A lot to like about him and all these other Arizona prospects. We're going to jump into our interview. We have a great guest now joining us to talk Zeke Nagy. Welcome back to Robin Hoop on Dash Radio's Nothing But Net channel, where this week we are joined by Adam Spinell, assistant men's basketball coach at Dickinson College, and also contributes to Celtics blog. Adam, thanks for coming back on the show this week.
I appreciate you having me. Always happy to talk some hoops here.
And this week, one of our focus players is Zeke Nagy. Tell me, what do you like about Zeke Nagy?
I think one of the things with Zeke is he's pretty mobile for somebody of his size. And when you're looking at the modern NBA and what it takes to succeed there as a big man right now, you have to be able to be deployed in multiple different types of pick and roll schemes defensively. And that's where having somebody who's really mobile and moves their feet well as a high energy type of player is really impactful. So while I'm not sure if there's one particular coverage he really thrives in more than another, his ability to be deployed in both is something that's going to make him a really unique fit at the next level.
What I really like about Zeke is he's a very fluid athlete, and he moves well. And what I like about that is there's other guys in this draft class that have the exact opposite problem, where you look at him, you say, all right, this guy's not real mobile. We know he's going to just kind of be stuck at, let's say, the center position. A good example of that would be Jalen Smith. Jalen Smith, when you watch him play, he's not real fluid. He just kind of, when you look at him, you say, that's a center. Whereas when I watch Zeke Nagy, he's a guy that really screams switchability, which is huge in the modern NBA. What do you think when you look at his projections, what positions do you think he's going to be able to play at the next level?
You know, for me, I always think about positions as who you can guard, not as much as what your offensive skills are. You know, offensively, it's just about finding five guys who you can really fit together within any type of offense. I mean, Ben Simmons breaks that stereotype. Giannis Antetokounmpo breaks that stereotype because offensively, they can do so many different things at their size. So for Najee, I think a four and a five are the types of guys that he defends really well. And then in talking about the switchability aspect, you know, there's going to be some moments of success or necessity where he needs to be out there switching on the guy who, you know, plays the 1-2-3 in those late clock situations. And I think he'll do fine there, but it's not a strength where I'd see him being somebody that's in like Golden State scheme, for example, where they purposely switch every single screen every time down the floor.
Yeah, correct. There's going to be some things where necessity plays a role. But yeah, that's not the scheme you're going to look at and say, all right, let's put this guy on a two. Let's put this guy on a three,
right.
In the entire game. But I do like that he has that ability where if he does have to switch, you're not necessarily concerned about it because he is a good athlete and he moves well. The interesting thing about Zeke Najee compared to, I would say, most prospects or even just most players, he's unique in the ability that he is actually a better offensive rebounder than he is a defensive rebounder, which to me is very unique.
It really is. And again, we talk about fit all the time throughout the draft process, where a lot of times for a player to really reach their potential and be deployed in the right way, they have to be able to fit with the pieces that go around them. And the coaching staff has to fit that piece into how they want to deploy their team. So with Najee, he needs to go to a situation where he's going to be allowed to play with his high motor and be just this energy providing big in whatever minutes he has. So, you know, putting him closer to the basket in most opportunities, asking him to be a pick and roll type of guy who's able to, you know, clean up any misses that maybe jump shooters have around him. That's his best role. You know, we talk a lot about shooting at the five as being something that's really important, and not to say that Najee doesn't have some stretch potential, but he's by far going to be more impactful as an offensive rebounder and a finisher. I know he's one of the most efficient finishers on high volume in this draft class, and you combine that with his high motor on the glass, you want to keep him within 10 to 12 feet of the basket as much as you can.
Yeah, and those are, you know, you mentioned a couple of the points that you actually mentioned in your video as well, which I definitely want people to, the listeners should go check out your channel on YouTube. You know, you talk about finishing, you talk about motor. The other thing you talk about is his pick and pop potential. And really, when you look at him as a shooter, very good form. It's consistent, which I really like. The I do have the same concern kind of that you do. A lot of people like to just assume players are going to be able to shoot NBA threes. And in my experience, that's just not the case. It's not a given. And so to me, if he is able to move out to the NBA three-point line, I think that's a bonus. But that's definitely not going to be what you're drafting him for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. Again, it's potential that draws your eye and makes you say, okay, maybe there's something more we can work on and develop with this guy. And it's going to depend on both Najee's natural abilities and what the priorities of the team drafting him are for how quickly he might add that facet to its game. But right now, he's much more of a mid-range presence from around 15 feet. I know Arizona faced a ton of 2-3 zone this year. There's a lot of teams in the Pac-12 that play it, and some of their non-conference opponents found it best to combat them. So Najee was used in the high post a lot, and he's a very good shooter up there. But one of the worry areas is anytime you put the ball in somebody's hands, you know, 10 feet or more away from the basket, you need to trust that they're going to make the right play if it's not just a shot. And that's one area where Najee, to be frank, has struggled a little bit. He's a little turnover prone, isn't somebody that creates off the bounce, and just hasn't made a lot of high level reads, at Arizona.
Yeah, he's not someone that you're going to look to make much for passing. Whether it's he's getting double teamed, whether it's just making the right reads, as you said. I mean, there's a reason why he didn't even average one assist per game. It's because that's not a skill that he necessarily possesses. Now, it's something I think that guys can work on, but some of it's a little bit of a natural thing. I think you're either an okay passer or you're not in some cases, and so that's one area where I definitely think he needs to work with whatever team he goes to, and finds a way to at least be not a negative, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's all about, again, functionality and the fit there. There are so many teams, and, you know, we talk about it. If you're going to be used as a pick-and-pop type of big at the NBA level, when you pop, you're realistically popping to the top of the key and maybe 2 or 3 feet to the left or right of that. So from those areas, if you're not shooting it, you're not a knockdown shooter from there, you have to be able to create for somebody else. And if he's shown a lack of proficiency in dribble handoffs or in making right reads when there's screens and cutters around him, that really limits his kind of upside to be used in those ways.
You know, one thing I noticed when I watched him play, you know, one of the last games I actually watched was they had that barn burner that went to overtime against Oregon. And he had some really nice plays inside. What I really appreciate about his game is the ability to draw fouls. Not necessarily at a high rate, but he's a smart player inside, and he's actually a decent free throw shooter. Do you think that those strengths are going to transition well into the NBA?
I think they do. You know, they're important skills to have, especially when you convert, when you get to the free throw line. I think that's a huge one. But the area that I caution people to really, and this has been a bugaboo for me for a while, but I caution people to dive too closely and say that if somebody's an effective free throw shooter, that means that they're going to be able automatically to add that 3-point shot to their game. It's a very different type of mechanic, a very different type of feel and rhythm and routine. So I think that with Najee, it's an important skill to have, but it's not indicative necessarily that 3-point success is going to follow.
Yeah, it's interesting too. And sometimes the reverse isn't true either. You look at a good example of a player I flash back to is Antoine Walker, who is a great 3-point shooter and a terrible free throw shooter. And so it's one of those things where people love to say, oh, look, he was a great free throw shooter in college, so he's going to be a good shooter. And yeah, maybe he will be a good shooter, but one doesn't necessarily mean the other. And that's where I think some people sometimes have a little bit of a disconnect when you're watching them play. I guess when we look ahead to this draft class, where do you kind of think of him in terms of the other big men? Are there other guys that you kind of think he's kind of in that same tier in terms of like skill set, or maybe where you project him to be in terms of his NBA career?
It's a great question, really a fascinating question that's going to be answered in a little bit of a roundabout way here, because the role of the big man through the draft process has really changed over the last few years. As the league has transitioned to more four-out offense and valuing skill at that four spot where you need to be able to shoot, facilitate, defend guards, and just be super mobile, there's not as much of a premium of drafting bigger guys earlier in the draft. So I don't think there's a ton of guys that we're going to see outside of the top, you know, 2 or 3 names in this class with Wiseman and Okongwu, Obi Toppin, and maybe Jalen Smith. I think those are the only guys that are real locks to go in the top 20 picks. Beyond that, there's just this whole cluster of guys, and it's going to be, like we mentioned, about fit. And some of them may knock into the later parts of the first round. Some of them may end up being more second round picks. I think Najee is right on that borderline right now, right on that cusp. I'd feel pretty comfortable in saying that he's probably, you know, picks 31 to 37 or 38 are a good range for him right now. And he offers, in comparison to a lot of the other names that are available for big men there, whether it's, you know, a Tyler Bay, a Killian Tilly, maybe even a Vernon Carey from Duke or Daniel Otoru from Minnesota, I think Najee is the only one who doesn't stand out and have this one go-to skill that he can hang his hat on other than his motor. All the other guys, maybe, you know, Tilly's the best pick and pop player. Tillman's a really good passer and defender. Bay is also a really good defender. Tyler Bay from Colorado. All of these guys have different skills that they can hang their hat on. And I don't know if Najee necessarily has one. It's his motor, his athleticism, his upside in all of these categories. So if there's a team that's looking to kind of split the difference and have somebody that checks a lot of boxes, as opposed to having somebody who vehemently just checks one box or one role, I think he kind of makes sense as the fit.
And I think that's a valid point. What really hurts him is when you say Zeke Najee, you don't say, oh yeah, this or this. You know what I mean? There's not one thing where he stands out necessarily. And the other thing that I think hurts him a little bit is, you know, you talk about how the center position is kind of being, it's very replaceable. And one of the things that you get from that center position, you know, you look at some of the guys that are being talked about as high-end picks, is rim protection. And that's an area, for example, that I think he definitely needs to improve. I don't think that he comes in and is going to be able to do that. And that's one of the areas that if you're a NBA team. That's one area that you look at and say, we really want that if we're going to draft a center. And the other thing would be being able to stretch the floor. Another thing that you just aren't sure of about him. And so I think that's what makes it a little tough when you're drafting Zeke Nnaji is the things that you're looking for from a modern center. And again, a position that is very replaceable, he doesn't have.
Yeah, very, very much so. And that's where it's going to come down to splitting hairs, where I think the type of team that drafts him is more likely going to be one that has the patience they can devote to him and not need to go and say, hey, you need to go get 8 to 15 minutes as a rookie and play these really impactful moments off the bench and be good at this one or two things. Like, he needs a little bit of time and seasoning in every single category. But if you look at his fluidity, his upside as an athlete, like we talked about at the beginning, his motor and just how hard he plays, you want to believe and invest and buy in that, so long as you have the opportunity to take a few years to let it develop.
Yeah, that's going to be the key. So are there any teams out there, let's say he goes like beginning of the second round, are there some younger teams or some maybe rebuilding type teams that would give him more of an opportunity early on? Or do you think pretty much no matter what, most teams are going to probably throw him in the G League for some time to really make sure he can grow and then get the necessary playing time to take those next steps?
Yeah, I see him as a prime G League type of candidate. If I'm looking at a couple teams in the earlier parts of the second round who, you know, might make the most sense for him, I think Minnesota at 33, looking for a little bit more of like a defense energy minded big man who would be almost a complement and backup to Karl Anthony Towns. You know, you could play them together theoretically because on offense, Towns shoots the ball so well, you might be able to do that for a few minutes. But I think that's a solid fit for him. And then 37 with Washington, you know, dependent on what they do with their pick at number 9, they may end up, you know, if they go in the backcourt or a wing with pick number 9, they may be looking for another big and somebody who can come in and stabilize a defense a little bit earlier on in their career, where that opportunity may lend itself to Nnaji.
Yep, I think that makes sense. And then now, just to touch on this real quickly before we let you go, and we touched on it a little bit briefly, you were thinking in the early second round is where he likely goes. Do you think there's a team that would maybe take a chance in the first round, or do you think it's likely he slides to the second? I think for me, what makes it tough for him to jump into that first round is you have a lot of teams at that end of the first round that are probably going to want guys that can really add to what they've already got there, because these are teams with, in most cases, championship aspirations. And a play like Zeke, I think the reason he slides into the second round and maybe slides even further a little bit, maybe to the middle of the second round, is that he is going to be more of a project.
Totally agree. And if you're looking at the end of the first round here, from picks 21 to 30, there's only one team in there that likely doesn't have championship aspirations next season as of where they're drafting right now, and that's the New York Knicks at 27. Now, I don't love that as a fit for Nnaji, because Tom Thibodeau taking over there, he is much more of a, you know, ice defense and keep his bigs back to rim protect and really value that type of skill over anything else. So I think that if they're looking for a big there, they're going to take somebody who doesn't have rim protection as a large improvement area, which is something Nnaji does. So again, I don't love the fits right now, but I will say with teams like Boston having picks 26 and 30, you know, they'll probably be looking to move out of one, if not both, of those slots. So if there's a team that just doesn't want to risk it, falls in love with Nnaji through this pre-draft process and wants to trade up and take him there, that's always an option as well.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting when I look at all of these Arizona prospects, what makes them a little different in some cases than a lot of the other prospects we've touched on, let's say on this show, is that I don't know that they're the types of players that fit on pretty much any team. I think there's going to be a certain team that really needs to want the skills that they possess. And so that's going to be a kind of a storyline to watch for. Before we let you go, I remind people where they can find you on social media and let us know if you have any new content coming out or if there's something recent that you put out.
Absolutely. And thank you again for having me on here. You can find me on Twitter at Spinella, S-P-I-N-E-L-L-A 1-4. On YouTube, adam.spinella, and then The Box in One is a website that I'm doing a lot of my writing for, as well as Celtics blog. Putting out a ton of draft content in the next month or so, starting to dive in. We've done a few mock drafts on YouTube, about 120 different scouting reports on players in this year's draft class, and then starting to do some breakdowns on skill categories. So we'll take the five or six best players at pick and pop shooting or rim protection or short roll passing and try to break those down into different and manageable ways. So I think there's a lot of fun, unique content coming out. Would love to share that with some listeners, and please always reach out if there's anything else that I can do to help you guys on this show or any listeners as well. Always looking forward to finding people to engage on these topics.
Awesome. And yeah, I encourage all our listeners to check out all that work. And it sounds very interesting what you got coming out. And thanks again for joining us this week.
Thank you so much.
Well, glad it still worked out.
Yeah. Thanks for having me again.
So basically, we're going to jump in on Nico Mannion this week. Well, we're looking at all the Arizona prospects on this week's show, but specifically with you here, we're going to talk about Nico, who I know you're pretty high on. So we'll let me get the recording started, and then we'll jump right in.
Cool.
Welcome back to Robin Hoop on Dash Radio's Nothing Minute channel, where this week we are joined by Spencer Perlman from The Stepien. Spencer, thanks for coming on the show again to talk some draft.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
So far, so good. It's always a good day when you can talk draft. And Nico Mannion, the focus for this week is definitely a fun prospect. What is it that you that really jumps off the page when we're talking about Nico Mannion for you?
I think his understanding of the game is pretty high. I think he's got a good IQ on both sides. But like skill-wise, I think he's a fantastic passer. Just below that LaMelo level, probably in, you know, like that Killian level. And the shooting, like regardless of what the percentages say, if you look back at his prior stuff, you know, in AAU and high school, he's always been a good shooter. I think really just kind of been a weird, you know, situation with him at Arizona.
Yeah, the shooting is very intriguing to me, and I definitely buy in. I know some people have some question marks. It's one of those things where, like you said, you look at the percentages and you might say, well, are we really going to get a high-level shooter? But I mean, the form looks good. I love his ability to shoot off the bounce. He's got a pretty good floater game, things that I think are going to be necessary given his size limitations. Do you have concerns about him and just in terms of what he's going to be able to do size-wise? Because, you know, in today's NBA, obviously a big part of what they do now is things like switchability. But given his size, he's going to be strictly playing the one.
Yeah, I mean, he's a one-position defender, unless if you're, you know, playing against a team that's starting or playing with two point guards at the same time. I mean, like legit point guards, not, you know, Russell Westbrook type points who can back you down. He's only defending point guard. So, you know, defensively, he's going to be at a disadvantage there because if you're switching, then he's, you know, just going to be eaten alive. And if he's not, you're going to need to have your team defense just completely on point. So yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the versatility hurts him. And I think that's part of the reason why he's, you know, dropping in some mocks from, you know, potential lottery pick to start the year to now towards the back end of the first round, early second.
Yeah, you mentioned he's a very high IQ player, and I would agree. And that's on both ends, whether it's, you know, offensively, whether it's the shooting, whether it's the passing. And then on the defensive end, despite the physical limitations, he's a very smart defender, puts himself in good positions to be successful. He's relatively quick. In some ways, I would say he's almost deceptively quick, just because the way he plays, you don't necessarily notice it right away. Concern that I have, though, about his game is his ball handling. Not that he's a bad ball handler necessarily, but it's not one of the skills that I look at him and think is kind of a plus. What are your thoughts on him as a ball handler specifically?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have the ball on, you know, the tightest string, I don't think. I don't think it's a negative. I just don't think it's really a clear positive, obviously, either. Just kind of in the middle, I guess. And, you know, that can somewhat be alleviated when you're a little bit bigger or when you have an athleticism advantage going downhill. And I actually think his quickness is slightly underrated just from a standstill. But, yeah, the handle, it's not great. But when he gets downhill, he's able to stop in a dime, and I think he can pull up really well, as you were talking about before.
Yeah, one thing you mentioned, you tweeted this out recently, and you talked about his ability to play off the ball more in the NBA. One guy that comes to mind in this specific class that I think is kind of in a similar mold, just in terms of what their role could potentially be, is Tyrell Terry, just in terms of a guy that maybe isn't a super high level ball handler, but is a very good passer, a smart defender, has some size limitations. But it, like you said earlier, there's definitely some teams out there that I think could use him, at least offensively, as an off-ball shooter, because he, to me, he's got such a good form, and he really projects to be such a good shooter that as long as you have a solid size guy next to him, I think that could make a really big difference in terms of where he's going to be able to go in his NBA career.
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal situation, he's playing with somebody like, you know, with another wing who can play on ball and off ball. But like, you know, if he can play next to a big wing initiator, whether it's someone like Simmons, who obviously handles a lot, or Luka or Giannis, LeBron, you know, whoever it is, just giving him more versatility and not just saying you're exclusively playing on ball, which is pretty much like, you know, that pretty much was his role at Arizona. I think that's going to allow for, you know, more lineups that he can be put out with, and it's just going to make him look better, and it's going to allow the team to be perform at a higher level when he's on the court on offense.
Do you have concerns about his ability to maybe not necessarily get to the hoop, but what he chooses to do there? You know, actually on the Steppy, and I know this wasn't your scouting report, but Zach Milner, he talked about how sometimes Nico had a tendency to rely too much on that floater game. While I think the floater is a really big part of what especially smaller guards need to bring to their game at the NBA level, I do think that could be a valid concern if he's not versatile enough in terms of a finisher.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think also a part of it was just him trying to sell calls when he was going downhill. So, you know, obviously you're taught when you go downhill to be strong with the ball. It didn't always seem like he was strong. He was just playing for the foul instead of playing for the shot. And then if you get the call, that's new, you know, you try to exaggerate a little bit, or that's when you actually play through it. To me, it just didn't really seem like he did that. It was just when he did attack, it was trying to get the contact, trying to sell the contact. But, you know, the floater, I think that's definitely going to be there. It's, you know, when that's at a high enough level to where he can then pull the defender around him, I think he'll probably be crafty enough to maybe fake the floater, you know, a little hesitation, and then just go underneath for a scoop. But the finishing, that's an issue. The floater, the touch, I don't really think is.
When you look at this class just in general, and you look at where he could possibly go, what is it that's going to be kind of his bread and butter if a team drafts him? In terms of like, what's the skill that he brings to the table that day one, maybe there's a team out there that could use it right away? Because to me, what I struggle with a bit with Nico is that, just given his limitations, you know, granted he's a good shooter, but there's some guys in this draft, I guess the way I would look at it, that you could say, I think any team could use this guy. But with Nico, I think it's a little different because just given his limitations and given his kind of a niche skill set, to me, I do think it's a little tougher to find a good fit for him.
I mean, he'll need a team that has a strong defensive, you know, back end to it, to where they can cover for him a bit, whether it's, you know, an elite rim protector or just smart guys who can rotate quickly off ball. You know, obviously Boston does a great job with it, and Marcus Smart and the scram switches. I think though his bread and butter, I mean, offense is just going to be, it's going to be shooting. It's going to be playing him off the ball, but then also having the ability to run the pick and roll and create, you know, looks for his teammates. Defensively, he's a smart defender. So, like, you know, he's not locking anybody up one-on-one, and he'll definitely be targeted. And we've seen in the playoffs how problematic that can be. But I think, you know, the way he's able to stay in front of guys, I think that's obviously going to be good. So whether or not he can then stay in front and exaggerate the contact and draw the charge, I think he's active with, you know, digging and stunting and everything that you're taught off ball, tagging the guys as they roll to the paint. But his role, I mean, it's going to be just strictly like he is a one, that's it. And he will just be used probably as a shooter and then someone who can run pick and roll, but not someone who you really want to give the full keys to and have him just say and say to him, hey, you know, you're the offense, do with it as you will.
So when you look at his NBA career or what it would potentially be, do you see him as a guy that could make an impact early on, or would you say it's more likely that no matter what, that he probably would spend some time, like let's say in the G League?
Yeah, I think he'll probably spend time in the G League early in his career. He has to get stronger. He has to get stronger just all around. He's got to attack the basket a little bit more. You know, those high impact guys, or the impact guys, rather, the guys who can actually make a positive contribution early on in their career, are usually, you know, the older guys who are probably a little bit more physically developed. You know, someone like Malachi Flynn, I think in this year's draft, he's going to come in right away, and I think he'll be like an impact player pretty much from day one. Nico, though, it's going to take him a little bit of time, but I do think he'll get there. And I think when he does get there, he's going to be a good backup point guard who can play some spot starter minutes when needed. And, you know, obviously the NBA is going to a more perimeter oriented game and more shooting. And I think he'll have that.
Yeah. That was actually my next question, is where do you see him? Cause for me, I do think he's going to be more of a career backup. He's you know, a player that kind of brings to mind, not necessarily in terms of their skill sets, but Tyus Jones, a player that I think, you know, is a very, very smart player, a very high IQ player on both ends, has some size limitations, but, you know, has the ability to hit some shots, and to me is going to be a career backup. He just doesn't have that high ceiling that you see from some of these other players. So I'm with you. I do think that ultimately he's going to be a spot starter and likely going to be mostly a backup point guard with whatever team he ends up going to. What are some, you know, we talked a little bit about the defense, but is there anything specifically that really stands out to you just in terms of red flags for his overall game?
I mean, the size, it's, I guess it's really just the size and how limited he is with who he can defend. That's, you know, really it. You know, the handling has to get better. I think that's going to happen, but I don't see anything major in terms of skills that he needs or skills that he will need to be a rotation player at the next level.
Where do you kind of have him ranked in terms of the point guards in this draft class? Like, do you kind of see him as, I mean, I've seen some people that say, all right, I think he's actually like maybe in the same tier as like a Cole Anthony. Some people say he's, you know, further down the list. It seems like he's a player that's all over the map. Where do you kind of see him just in terms of the point guard specifically?
Yeah, I think he's definitely below Cairo and Cole. If I had to group him in with some guys, you know, it'd probably be Nico, it'd be Tyrell Terry. I'd have Malachi actually above him. Not in a separate tier, but if those guys are both there, I'm taking Malachi. I'm a huge fan of Malachi Flynn. Cassius Winston would be another guy who would have in the same area, even though he obviously has his major defensive concerns as well. Yam Madar, just, you know, late first round, early second round, just that weird grouping of like 6-7 point guards.
Yeah, that seems to be an area that's pretty common. I know some people are higher than others, and I don't know that too many people feel he's got any sort of a lottery floor in terms of where he's going to go now. I do think, to me personally, I think he probably goes in that early second round. That seems to me to be where you'd have maybe one of these younger teams, a team that's maybe not ready to necessarily compete yet. And that, to me, seems like it could be a good spot for him to land as one of those teams. Is there a team out there that you think maybe is a good fit for his game?
Yeah, I'd like to see him in Philly. I think they have a good enough defense around him. I think they can actually move Josh Richardson to the two, because he's definitely not a point guard. And you'll be able to still play with the ball, play the offense through Simmons. And then when Simmons goes to the bench, you have a point guard who can actually run the offense with Joel Embiid. I just think it's a good fit. You know, you have the guys around who can cover for him on defense, but you also allow him some offensive versatility to where he's not just pegged into any single role from day one. He can play on ball and can play off ball a bit.
That's funny. The last person I asked, they said the same thing. They said he'd be a great fit in Philly. So that's starting to become kind of the team that people think would be a good fit. And I can't disagree. I do think that he could add something to what they've got going there. Before I let you go, remind people where they can find you on social media. If you have anything coming out, I obviously want to encourage listeners to check out your work and your scouting reports on the Stepien. I know last time we had you on, you kind of teased that you had some stuff in the works behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's still ongoing. it's Fair been enough. A long process, but it's. I mean, I'm hoping I can share it with everybody sooner or soonish. I don't know if I'll be able to, but that's still happening. But in terms of where you can find me, Twitter at SK Perlman, and all of my scouting reports that I've done up until I stopped because of the project, you know, a few months ago, can be found at The Stepien.
Perfect. Well, thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Welcome back to the Robin Hoop NBA Draft Show on Dash Radio's Nothing But Net channel, where now we are joined by draft and overall hoops expert Corey Talaba, who hails from Hardwood Herald. Corey, thanks for joining us this week.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I'm excited to talk draft, as I always am. So it's going to be fun.
So let me start with this. Tell the listeners a little more about Hardwood Herald. What exactly is Hardwood Herald? What do you guys do there?
Yeah, so the Hardwood Herald is a basketball media site that I started a few years ago. You know, initially it was kind of just, you know, your classic articles. And over the last few years, we've kind of transitioned from a lot of written word to a lot of video. We do a daily NBA show. We specialize, I think, in the NBA draft, where I've been doing a ton of, you know, pretty in-depth video breakdowns, going over prospects, strengths, weaknesses, how they're going to fit into the NBA and with NBA teams. And, you know, we're doing something pretty cool for the release of our big board pretty soon that I will be announcing probably in the next, you know, week or two that I'm very excited about. So, you know, definitely be on the lookout for that.
Very cool. Yeah. You guys put out great content. You put out consistent content, which a lot of people can't say, which is always nice. So I definitely encourage our listeners to give you a follow and watch your videos on YouTube. Follow you guys, hardwoodherald.com, of course. So let me let's jump in here on our focus this week. What is the first thing that comes to mind for you when you think about Nico Mannion?
You know, Nico is very interesting as a prospect because he came into this season as a projected lottery pick. And, you know, if you saw him prior to his college play, it's because, you know, he was on many kind of ball is life type mixtapes. His college play, I think, left a lot to be desired out of a lot of people because he really just, he didn't shoot it as well as you would have expected him to. And I think that, you know, as a point guard nowadays, you have to be able to shoot it. And I think people are concerned about his size at the next level and his overall athleticism. But I think that there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about Nico. It's all about what kind of expectations do we have for him. And I think at this point, maybe he's getting even a little bit underrated as a prospect.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, you talked about how he originally was talked about in the lottery. And there's a lot of players that, for whatever reason, throughout their year, other guys jump and they start to drop. And it's not that they're not good players and it's not that they possess skills, but maybe they just weren't able to focus or showcase them as much. You know, for example, at his school, he's not the only guy that's going to get drafted, you know, maybe in the first round. You know, you've got two other prospects, high level prospects as well. So I think that makes it a little more tough because it takes the focus off of his game. And obviously there's more for people to watch when you're watching Arizona. For example, when I'm diving into game film with a team like that, I'm watching every game more than once because you want to be able to focus on each player individually. It's tough to watch all three at once, especially when all three are starters and they're playing major minutes. One thing you mentioned was kind of the physical limitations. When I watch him on the defensive end, I think that's one of the areas that kind of gives me a little bit of pause. Not that he's not a smart defender, because he's a fairly high IQ guy on that side, but he does have physical limitations. He does have the length concerns. Do you think he can at least be, let's say, maybe not a negative defender at the next level eventually?
It's going to be a while, I think. You know, that obviously is the biggest concern with him, I think. Even more so than the shooting. Because, you know, when I look at shooting, I look at form. I look at shot selection. The percentages, I think, aren't... it's going to be an easier time for him transitioning into being a consistent shooter than it is on the defensive end. I think teams are going to pick on him pretty early. You know, you put him in a pick and roll, you get him switched on to somebody a little bit bigger. it's going to be tough. He's a one position defender. And, you know, now in the NBA, teams are looking for guys that could switch everything, guard multiple positions, and his size, his length just doesn't really allow it. So for me, it's a legitimate concern, and it's all about, where is he going to go? What team is going to draft him? What team is going to give him an opportunity? Because if he goes to a team that is ready to compete right away, you know, say he gets drafted in the later end of the first round, those teams have good records. And are they going to have the patience to have, you know, this guy get murdered, you know, time after time on the defensive end? Probably not. If he goes maybe earlier in the second round to a team that may be rebuilding, it might be easier for him to get consistent minutes and go through his struggles on the defensive end, but learn from them and figure out his strengths and what he could do on that end to be a solid defender in the long run. But it's definitely going to be tough on him in the beginning, in my opinion.
Yeah, switchability is so big in the modern NBA, and there's no switchability with Nico. I mean, granted, he's going to be a pretty good shooter. So sure, on offense, will he be able to maybe play a little bit of the two just in terms of being an off-ball guy that can shoot? But on the defensive end, I mean, he's one of those players that, as they say, you're going to try to hide because they're going to take advantage of the fact that he just doesn't have the size. And I think that's going to be one of his big downfalls. And it is going to take time. And you're right, the team that he goes to is going to have some patience on that end. I do think he's going to be a guy that probably spends some time in the G League because he's going to have to develop those skills. And you want him to get playing time. Like you said, if he goes to go at the end of the first round, those are really good teams, and they can't just throw anyone out there. So it's one of those guys that if he goes to one of the better teams, they're going to, you know, probably let him sit for a year or two because he's going to need some sort of playing time before he's really going to be NBA ready. And that's one of my concerns with him. You know, there's other players in this draft. A guy that, to me, is kind of in a similar mold just in terms of the type of player he could be is Tyrell Terry. Now, Tyrell Terry, I think, mm-hmm. is a much better prospect. But just in terms of, to me, they have similar aspects. You know, you don't have a lot of size with Tyrell Terry, both good shooters, and there's definitely some question marks in terms of size and things of that nature. When I look at his game specifically, so Nico, is he a player? So we don't know what's going to happen as far as the pre-draft process is concerned. Do you think he's a player that would be hurt or helped as far as having some sort of a pre-draft process, whether it be combine, looking at, you know, physicals, whether they're able to do any sort of workouts, things like that? How do you think that could impact his draft stock?
He's one of the guys that it would definitely help. You know, again, he went from being a projected lottery pick to a guy that back end of the first round, maybe in the second round, and who knows how far he could drop, you know, from that point as the draft goes on. So I think that if teams could get him into a workout and he could show off actually knocking down shots at a consistent level, if he could give these guys a little bit of a preview of what his vision looks like, maybe, you know, even if it's just doing pick and roll stuff with trainers, I think it has to help because, you know, again, I buy into the shot. It looks good. He's able to shoot it in a variety of different ways. Like you said, maybe he could play off ball a little bit. He runs off screens, catch and shoot. He can shoot it off the bounce a little bit. He's just at the college level, he took shots that he's not going to take at the NBA. So I think that if he could get in front of NBA teams and they could actually see that, you know what, this kid can stroke it. And while, yeah, we have the defensive concerns, it's only going to help him, especially, you know, he's a bright kid. There's a lot of video available of him giving interviews, breaking down film and whatnot. So he's a bright kid who sees the game well. If he can get into this combine, talk to actual teams, I think teams, you know, will be a little bit more in on him than they are now. Granted, that might still not be until the end of the first round. Like, it might not help him get back into the top half, but it may help him from dropping, you know, further than he could.
Yeah, he's definitely a player that, to me, is all over the board when you look at where he could potentially land. Because I don't see him as a player that necessarily has a team where I say, all right, this is a team I think that really wants an undersized guy that can only play one position on defense. That's not something you're saying to yourself as a GM. Man, I really hope I can find this in the draft. They're so hard to come by. That's what's so tough with just kind of his archetype. The one thing when I watch him play, and this is actually goes back to my Tyrell Terry comparison, is I have question marks a little bit with him in terms of being a ball handler. Not that he's a bad ball handler, but when I watch him play, I don't, he's definitely not high level enough where he's able to get out of, you know, for example, double teams. He's immediately looking to throw the ball to somebody. There's just not a lot of high level dribbling, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does. And you're right. Like even when, you know, he'll get blitzed on a screen, he's never really able to get around it, or he very rarely will make like the high level read. He'll, like you said, he'll just kick it out to an open man, which to a point is not necessarily a bad thing because he's not trying to do things he's not capable of, turning the ball over. He's keeping the possessions. But yeah, his handle, which I actually think his handle is probably a little bit better than Tyrell Terry's. And I actually buy into the fact that I think he has a very good first step. So he's quick off the bounce. So if he's in a one-on-one situation, you know, I do think he's going to be able to get by guys, especially with more space in the NBA. But his handle, yeah, he's not, you know, Cassius Winston, LaMelo Ball, you know, one of these guys who are just kind of wizards with the ball in their hands.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But the one thing he does have is, now granted, if he had higher ability to be a, you know, high level ball handler, that would make a difference. But he has shown the ability to be a very high level passer, very in terms of high IQ, a very, very solid passer. He makes good reads, makes smart decisions, and he's not turnover prone. And to me, that's where you really can make a name for yourself if you're Nico Mannion, is that you're a guy that makes few mistakes on the offensive end. He works hard on the defensive end. And as you said, it's a lot of it. The question would be, do you think his shot is going to translate? And what's interesting to me is, I think part of the reason why maybe he wasn't more efficient in college is because at times he took some difficult shots. What are your thoughts on that?
No doubt. He shot it off the bounce a lot. And, you know, I think that if you look at the team that Arizona had, it's not like they had a plethora of shot creators, you know, looking into, you know, potential first round pick Josh Green, it's not like he was a wizard off the bounce. So I think that there were a lot of times that Nico, you know, he did have to take tougher shots. At the next level, he's going to be a guy who is shooting spot up shots. You know, he's going to take away a lot of the mid range shots that he had in his game. You know, he shot a lot of mid range jumpers. And the NBA teams are not going to allow him to do that. So I think that's going to bump his percentages up. You know, he's a very talented shooter. Like I said, he could shoot it in a multiple variety of ways, off the bounce, catch and shoot, running off screens, give him some, you know, flare action, some floppy. He's going to be a good shooter. To me, that's the least of my worries. But if he comes in and tries to be the guy who's taking a ton of shots off the bounce, like if he has that much freedom, yeah, he's going to struggle, especially with, you know, NBA level defenders with size and length and everything. But if he just simplifies his game and his shot profile, like I think he's going to at the next level, like I think NBA coaches are going to have him do at the next level, I have no doubt his shot's going to translate.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And I think a lot of it's going to depend on the team he goes to, how quickly we see that and we see him able to make an impact. And that's going to be one of the biggest things, is what team is going to take a chance on him. Well, one thing I saw, there was a scout that said he has really good touch. And that's one of the reasons why I do think, you know, his shooting is going to translate. Because there's some guys that they maybe have a pretty good percentage, but maybe they're not shooting a lot of shots. And the ones that do shoot, maybe they go in sometimes, but they don't have touch. I think touch is something that really can set a person kind of aside, especially given he's shown a really being able to be good on floaters, which I think when you jump into the NBA, especially for a guy that doesn't have a ton of size, that is a huge aspect of the NBA game. I think to be able to, because floaters, there's a lot of players. A good example would be Tyus Jones. When he played with the Wolves, who that's kind of my team is the Wolves. And when he was there, that's one thing he really worked on is the floater game. Because I think if you're undersized, that's a big part of what you're going to do when you're driving into the lane. Because without that, it's so much easier for guys to block you. It's so much easier. Your gravity changes when you're driving. And so do you think the floater game is going to translate? And is there some other aspect of his game? You know, we talk about the shooting. What is he really going to rely on, would you say, aside from like the three-point shooting? Do you think he can rely on that floater game in terms of driving? Or is there another aspect of his game offensively that's really going to set him apart?
Well, you know, from a scoring perspective, Yeah, he's going to have to rely on that floater game a lot. You know, if I was him, I would start watching, you know, the Tony Parker film as soon as I can. He also was a pretty good finisher around the hoop, but I do think that'll be a struggle for him as he makes the adjustment, as it is with a lot of rookies. You know, when you got, it's much different from, you know, some guy who's a high level D1 athlete, but is probably going to go, you know, be an accountant or a lawyer versus, you know, Anthony Davis waiting at the rim for you. So yeah, that floater game is going to be so important. And he does have good touch, and he's actually got good touch with both hands, left and right, which is, you know, something that's going to be advantageous to him. If he's, because he's not going to be a high level free throw guy. You know, he got to the line at a pretty decent rate in college, but I just can't see refs, you know, at the NBA level at his size, you know, calling a lot of these fouls. And a lot of these defenders are they're going to be so much better at getting into position. So that floater is going to be huge for him. And I think it's going to be, you know, threes, you know, layups, floaters, that's going to be his sweet spot as a scorer. And then, you know, the other thing that he's going to have to rely on to get on the court is, like you said, that vision that he has, that high IQ play. You know, I kind of liken him to, you're looking at maybe like a DJ Augustine level career. Like that would be my hope if I was drafting him. DJ Augustine's been a very high level contributor, you know, throughout his career, but he's not, you know, a guy that you necessarily think of when you're thinking of best point guards in the league. So for me, he's a guy that, you know, I look at, be like, Nico could definitely be a spot starter one day, depending on the team. He's a guy that if he's your first, you know, point guard off the bench, it's probably going to be pretty good. And I had a scout tell me, you know, if Luke Ridenour could play 14 years in the league, then Nico will be able to play too. So, you know, I'm high on that aspect of his game.
That's a really good point. To me, when I look at Nico Mannion, I think his career would be best spent being, if he's going to be, let's say, Luke Ridenour. Luke Ridenour was able to start, but I think Nico is going to mainly be, to me, like you said, a spot starter and a backup point guard. So he's going to be like a guy that's going to come off the bench, and as long as he does what he does in college, you know, makes smart decisions, plays with that high IQ, makes the right passes, and hits open shots, I think he could have a really long career, and I think that's very fair to say. Let me end it with one last question for you. So if you had to, you look into your crystal ball here at the NBA draft, where do you think he likely goes? Where do you think he should go? And is there any team that really jumps off the page for you in terms of being a good fit?
Man, that's a tough one. You know, I kind of think that the smoke is real and that, you know, teams aren't very high on him. So I think there's a pretty like good chance that he ends up in the second round. And, you know, as far as teams, I look at that 34th pick, that 36th pick that the Sixers have. And I think, you know, Nico maybe could be a guy that could go to Philly and kind of fit in with them as a guy who can kind of be a secondary playmaker and a guy who will be able to hit spot up jumpers with Ben Simmons. And with Simmons and Embiid, you know, thinking that they stay this year in Philly, you know, they can kind of cover up for him on the defensive end. So I could see him kind of slipping past those first round guys, getting into the second round. And I think, you know, with Philly having those two picks, if they keep them, I would look maybe at that spot in particular.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I could understand why they would probably be a good fit. And that'd be a guy that they would look to maybe grab. And he's good value if you grab him in the second round. I can definitely say. So before we let you go, tell people again where they can find you on social media, where they can find you, what your website is. And then again, if you have anything you want to plug that's maybe coming out soon or that maybe just came out.
So you can find me on social media at Hardwood Herald, pretty much everywhere. You can go to hardwoodherald.com to find, you know, a conglomerate of all of the content. But if you want to look specifically for all the draft breakdowns in one spot, you can go to YouTube, search Hardwood Herald, you know, 2020 NBA draft playlist. You can go right there. Every Tuesday, I have an episode of my podcast, Nothing But Netflix, come out where I break down, you know, some kind of basketball movie, TV show, documentary. Which is a lot of fun. And yeah, keep an eye out. I have a, you know, pretty fun announcement for something that is either going to be really cool or really stupid that I put out in regards to my big board that I'll be dropping pretty soon. you know, I'll probably announce it on Twitter and my website and all that. So as long as you're following me in one of those places, you'll find out what it is when it's announced.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for joining us, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right, so this week's show is going to end with my personal take and go over my what I've scouted as far as Arizona prospect Nico Mannion. All right, so when I look at Nico Mannion, it's not that I'm not a fan of his, because I am. I do like Nico Mannion. My issue a little bit is, at least in some aspects of his game, I would argue that he's kind of a small two-guard, just depending on how you look at him. A very good shooter. Now, his percentages are interesting. They're not amazing, right? You look at some of the shooting percentages, and you'd probably like them to be a little higher. I think that's fair to look at his game and say that. So that's one thing to kind of watch for as we're kind of going through player by player here, or as we're going, I should say, stat by stat or area of his game. So if you're looking at specifically his three-point percentage, right, under 33%, so 32.7%. Now, granted, it's a large sample size, right? 162 attempts. So it's not like it's a small sample size. But I do think that some of that is shot selection, because he has a tendency to take some difficult shots. I'm not even just talking from three. Just in general, I do think he could afford to take better shots. And when he gets to the NBA, hopefully that's the case. Hopefully teams are going to hold him a little more accountable when it comes to stuff like that. But ultimately, I do think that his shooting's going to translate. Just today, actually, I saw a video that was released of him taking some shots. That's kind of this time of year, right? When you're going into draft season, players start to put out that open gym highlight film, or when you're taking on the chair. That's the other one that's always funny. But for me, I do think Nico Mannion, his shot is going to take. I'm not that worried about it. Pretty good free throw shooter at 79% on 131 attempts. Now, he didn't lead the team in attempts. Zeke Nnaji did, 200 attempts for Zeke Nnaji. But 131 attempts is pretty good. So he's shown the ability to get to the line, which is good to see. Now, when I look at him as a prospect, the one thing I think about is, if we're going to talk about him as a point guard, the issue that I run into is that I do think he needs to be better as a ball handler. I am not super excited when I think of him when it comes to his ball handling abilities. For example, he's very prone to getting double teams, and you know, some guys are able to attack double teams and get out of those successfully as ball handlers. He's not able to do that. In fact, you know, it's one of those things where if you watch, the double team comes and it's like he's looking to get rid of that ball immediately and pass it off. It's one of those things where another player this brings to mind, let's say this, another player this brings to mind is Tyrell Terry. Tyrell Terry is a very good shooter, much, much better shooter than Nico Mannion. I'm not comparing that. But when you look at just specifically the weaknesses of a player, that's the same kind of thing I think about when I think of Tyrell Terry, is that I do have concerns about him as a ball handler. Now, in addition to ball handling, though, the other area where I do think those two are very similar is in terms of defense. I think they're actually both very smart defenders. Tyrell Terry is a better defender. To me, no questions asked. But Nico Mannion is a very smart defender, and I like that about him. The problem, of course, that you're going to run into with Tyrell Terry, he just doesn't have much for size. That's going to be a legitimate concern. He's not all of a sudden going to have longer arms and be taller. It's not going to happen. That's something to watch for. Whoever drafts him has to understand that it's really going to be very, very much dependent on the lineups you're putting him in, the teams that you're playing, whether or not he's going to fit in with what you're doing. One team that was talked about in the interviews for Nico Mannion, and I've had a number of people bring this up, is the Sixers. The Sixers could be a team that could target a player like Nico for his shooting and for his basketball IQ. Coming off the bench as another guard, I think, would be very beneficial for a team like the Sixers. And when you look at where he's going to go, think about this. At the end of the first round, at the early second round, is where you're talking about. So at the end of the first round, of course, you're talking about championship caliber teams. Unless you've traded that pick, are those teams going to look at Nico Mannion and say, this is the guy that brings what we're missing? This is the guy that is going to really be able to solidify something? To me, I don't know if that's the case. is he going to be able to jump in day one and make an impact? That's a question mark, right? Now, for the Sixers, the reason why a team like that can make some sense is because they're going to be doing some retooling, it sounds like, of their roster. Things are probably going to get shaken up quite a bit because they have not had success with the current mold and with the current roster. And so things are probably going to change there. Now, if you're a rebuilding team and you're saying to yourself, I'm going to take a guy that early in the season was thought of as a lottery prospect. I'm going to take that player, right? And I'm going to see if we can figure out a way to really maximize his talents. Now, again, if you're going to use him as a point guard, the thing you have to keep in mind is he's not guarding anyone else. I don't see him guarding shooting guards, right? He's not going to be able to do that. And so you're going to play him specifically at the point guard position. Now, on offense, of course, he can play a little off ball. That's not a problem. So if you have a larger point guard, for example, we mentioned the Sixers. You don't think he could play a little off ball with Ben Simmons? So Ben Simmons brings the ball up. Nico Mannion is spotting up for threes, for example. There's options that you have with Nico Mannion. He's a very, very talented player, very high IQ player. So you just have to recognize when you draft him what his limitations are going to be. Of course, size, things like that, you can't do anything about that. Now, if he can get stronger, which that's kind of the knock on all young players, right? And it's a very generalized thing. But we go back to that talk about Tyrell Terry. Tyrell Terry got stronger already. He's already put on 20 pounds of muscle. Nico Mannion, I watched a little bit of his highlight video or just his like practice video that just got released. I couldn't really tell from that whether or not he had gotten bigger or not. At a glance, it didn't seem like it, but I'm sure he has. And once he gets into the NBA and gets into a strength and conditioning program, you're going to see that change. And he's going to be able to put them out. So that's not a problem with me. But you look at 6'3", his wingspan is 6'2.5", so he actually has a negative wingspan. So these are all things that you just want to keep in mind if you're an NBA team and you're drafting Nico Mannion. Or if you're a fan of an NBA team and you want your team to draft Nico, just keep in mind these deficiencies when you're looking at him as a prospect. That's kind of the way I sit with it so far. Now, in addition, let's take a look at kind of the specifics of his actual numbers. Now, Nico Mannion, we talked about, very good shooter. How good is he in certain aspects of his game? Let's dive deeper into those specifics. Now, of course, I already talked about I do trust his shooting. I think he's going to be a good shooter at the next level. Now, the one issue, of course, is going to be, is he going to have any issues getting his shot off being a shorter player? There's going to be question marks there, especially he's not a great ball handler. Creating his own shot could be an issue at times. Although, I will say this. In college, he showed a propensity to be able to hit some really difficult jump shots. So I'm interested to see how he transitions to the next level. And we talked earlier when we were looking at these players, sometimes you see a lot of prospects that have a few areas generalized they're excellent in. He's not one of them. Very interesting when you go down the list, whether it's transition where he's just average, in just the half court, you know, kind of the generalized half court offense, he is just average. And we're talking 44th percentile for transition, 48th percentile in overall half court. And actually, he's listed as good, which is 52%. 52% is not good in my estimation as far as your ranking. Only 0.87 points per possession, just overall offensively. So those are things that I think it's fair to say it's not ideal, right? Now, if we go into the more of the jump through the hoops of the generalized numbers and we kind of go into the really, really specific areas, a lot of those are issues too. There's not a ton of areas where you look at his game and he really necessarily excels, if that makes sense. Nothing jumps off the page. You know, he's pretty good, you know, when he's picked. So a dribble off a pick and what's considered a takes a dribble jumper, he is pretty good at that. 64%. And that goes to what I was talking about earlier, that he sometimes can hit some really difficult shots. Now, in the NBA, I don't know if he's going to be allowed to take those difficult shots because that's one of those things where you might have a short leash as a young player. Things to watch for. And that continues if you go into the high pick and roll and then you swing down to dribbling off a pick. He's good there as well. Very good, in fact. 70th percentile, just a little bit under 1 point per possession, and that's 84 possessions. So this is not a small sample size. We have seen him excel in that level. So, again, an area where you want to watch as he gets to that next level. A few things when you jump into the defensive metrics as far as defenders being up close on him. And one thing that really stands out to me is right side pass outs is what they label it as. So basically you're talking about pick and roll. He's the ball handler. The defensive player commits. So on the right side pass out, he has 36 possessions, poor, 14%. 14th percentile, almost under half a point per possession. This is a troubling statistic, right? And this goes back to what I was talking about. He's just not as strong of a ball handler as I would like him to be. Those are question marks. Now, going back to, we talked about dribble jumpers. The same can be said as a spot-up shooter. In spot-up situations where he's a dribble jumper, 84 percentile. That is excellent rating. So that's what we're talking about here is as a dribble jump shooter, he's really good. I mean, he's not elite necessarily by any means. We've seen that in the numbers, but that's one of the areas where he truly excels. And that's 20 possessions, 22 points. Not the biggest sample size ever, but when you take that into account with the other areas where we've seen that one dribble or the dribble jump shooting, that's where he tends to be at his best. So that's kind of where we're looking at. Now, off screens, one thing, the other area that I'll add, it's kind of interesting. When he's coming off to the shooter's left and he comes off straight, he is 10% poor. But when he comes off right, it's excellent, 83rd percentile. I mean, the numbers are what they are. Ultimately, you're going to kind of think what you want about Nico Mannion. We're talking a 6'3" guard, limited wingspan, limited physicals, not the quickest guy in the world, although I have some people talk about how they think he has a decent first step. I don't know about that. I'm not sure that I really buy into him as going to be a player that's going to have a plus in terms of speed. So there are real question marks here when it comes to Nico Mannion. Ultimately, I'm going to picture him probably going in that early second round is my guess. So probably in that, like, I'm not going to say first pick in the second round. I think I just don't see that happening. Probably in that, like, 5 to 10 range, or 5 to 15 range, I should say, in that second round. Maybe someone takes a flyer late first, but to me, I think early second is likely where Nico Mannion ends up going. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Robin Hoop on Dash Radio's Nothing But Net channel. As always, I encourage you to take a listen to any of the content that our interviewees puts out. Make sure you follow them on social media. And to anyone that has websites, things like that, I definitely encourage, we have great guests on this show, and they put out fantastic content, and I always want our listeners to check them out. Again, you've been listening to Robin Hoop on Dash Radio's Nothing But Net channel. If you missed any of this show, you can find us anywhere podcasts are found, whether that's Podient, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, etc. And until next week, we'll see ya.
With the first pick in the 2003 NBA Draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select LeBron James.
With the 13th pick in the 1996 NBA Draft, the Charlotte Hornets select Kobe Bryant.
With the first pick in the 2015 NBA Draft.
With the third pick in the 2018 NBA Draft.
With the first pick in the 1998 NBA Draft,
the Orlando Magic
Michael Olcandy.
With the first pick in the 2019 NBA Draft, the New Orleans Pelicans select Zion Williamson from Duke.